WFSU-FM now presents a delayed broadcast of the NEBA, Network of Entrepreneurs and Business Advocates, luncheon meeting of November 29, 2016. This program was recorded at the Capital City Country Club in Tallahassee. The topic is Florida's present and future business climate and how that might be impacted by new state legislative leadership and a new administration in Washington. Now, to get the program underway, here's NEBA President Barney Bishop.
Well, I'm going to introduce to you the moderator, who is a dear friend of mine that I met back in 2009 when she became the executive editor of Sunshine State News. And if you're somebody that likes a center right to further right, not an alt-right, but a right perspective on any issues, I encourage you to go to sunshinestatenews.com. And I read it every morning, and I've always got some kind of comment that I might make about some story that's written. But if you're interested in writing a column from time to time, can be once a quarter, can be once a month, please come see Nancy afterwards, because she's always looking for columnists to write stories that her readers would be interested in. Let me tell you a little bit about Nancy. She's a Connecticut native. She's a graduate of Elon University in North Carolina. Did a little checking on them. That is a very good school. And she earned her bachelor's degree in both English and French. So that's quite amazing. And she also graduated from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill with a master's degree in journalism. She began her journalism career at the Daily Mirror and at the Observer newspapers, both in London, England. She was a war correspondent for the Observer during Vietnam War. She covered me when I was on the front lines. She also briefly covered SHAPE and NATO headquarters in Brussels and Paris, respectively. Boy, what assignments, huh? That must have been some wild times. She returned to the U.S. And it was wild, because she not only came back with a husband, but she came back with seven children. So I guess the question is how much writing did you really do? But thereafter, she served as the city editor, the managing editor, and the associate editor of the Stewart News and the Port St. Lucie News for 28 years, retiring from Scripps Treasure Coast newspapers in 2005. She was named the executive editor of the Sunshine State News in December of 2009. Nancy is a past president of the Florida Society of Newspaper Editors and is the winner of numerous awards, particularly for her newspaper columns. She and her husband Mick were victims of Hurricane Francis and Jean in Stewart, Florida in 2004, and Katrina in Ocean Springs, Mississippi, and in 2005, and now lives in Tallahassee. Were you here when the last hurricane came through?
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, we need to send you on a cruise or something then during hurricane season. So it's my pleasure to introduce a dear friend of mine and somebody that I respect tremendously, Nancy Smith.
Sometimes I feel old enough to be in World War II. Believe me, I do. The first panelist I'm going to introduce to you, I'm going in alphabetical order here, is, I think, probably secretly a CIA agent, and that's Brewster Beavis. He gave me the shortest bio that I've ever seen. So I asked Barney for a little bit more, and he gave me one sentence, so I should be talking to his mother and really find out about it. Okay. Brewster is Senior Vice President of State and Federal Affairs for Associated Industries of Florida. He coordinates AIF's lobby team and all research advocacy efforts in Tallahassee and Washington, D.C. He previously served as Senior Director of Legislative Affairs for the National Association of Builders and Contractors. He also worked in Congress for several years and was a presidential appointee in the Bush administration. He is a graduate of Florida State University with a bachelor's degree in international affairs. Brewster also serves as chairman of the Florida H2O Coalition and is a former state board member for March of Dimes. He lives in Tallahassee with his wife Amanda and sons Liam and Drew. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dominic Calabro is president and CEO of Florida Tax Watch. He also serves as president and chief executive officer of the Prudential Productivity Awards, which recognizes, rewards, and works to replicate outstanding government productivity and innovative cost-saving achievements throughout Florida government, worth more than $9 billion to date. I don't think he is, I think. Maybe he is. Dominic received his bachelor's degree with highest honors from Florida International University, a master's from Florida State University, and will soon receive a second master's in public finance and budgeting. I will now go to Bill Hurley. Bill Hurley is executive director for the National Federation of Independent Business, Florida's and the nation's leading small business association. He manages NFIB's state operations in Florida to include his lobbying member support and statewide political media functions. Bill is a recognized leader in Tallahassee with a highly impressive track record of supporting the small business community and advocating for pro-business policies. He served as NFIB Florida State Director from 1990 to 2001 and rejoined NFIB as Executive Director in March 2007. From 2001 to 2007, he served as Vice President of Governmental Affairs and Political Action for the Florida Retail Federation, where he lobbied effectively and successfully grew their political efforts. Let's see, I think that's probably all I will give you. Sorry. Okay, what I'd like to do, I think you did not probably give the rules. Should I state the rules? The rules as I see them is that each speaker will have 2 minutes to give an opening statement, and then I will ask questions, and they'll each have a minute to answer those questions. And if somebody has heard something else they want to address from another speaker at the end of that period, they can go ahead and say something more. But just to keep it going and keep it lively, that's what we'll do. I hope I ask all the questions that you're interested in here. At the end, you'll each have, I believe, a two-minute summary.
Two? They said 20.
Two-minute summary of us?
No, you will each have a closing statement for 2 minutes. I think the way this is set up, we've been so close to the debates, it seems very debate-like, but it's not really. Okay, I'd like to begin by asking you this. Considering the new leadership in each chamber, Joe Negron in the Senate and Steve Corcoran in the House, considering their personalities and the agenda each has discussed, could you briefly describe the challenges you see before you in this session to make Florida's business climate more competitive? And we can start, I think we can just start on this end with Bill.
Sure. if this is working and you want us to see, sit from here, turn it on. There you go. This is working. Thank you, Nancy, and thank you, Barney, and what a great audience. And you know, anyone that gets on a panel with Dominic Calabro has light duty. If you know him and love him like I do, this will be my only 2 minutes, so I'm going to take advantage of it.
You betcha.
We wanted to give you an overall business perspective, and I'm happy to have some comment on leadership. and how that's going to direct the course of this session. First of all, about NFIB, we're a small business advocacy group. If you want to think about who is an NFIB member, I was so pleased to see Miss Peggy Monroe, who's been, been a member of our organization forever. We represent Main Street. We don't represent corporate Florida. We represent the independent business owners across the state. And as such, our number one issue is going to be workers' compensation. And I do have some breaking news for you on that, and I hope I can squeeze that in and give you some perspective on that issue that's very much going to affect the jobs and the economy. In terms of the nature of the leadership this year, we see, you know, I think all of us go back to before term limits when we used to have a much more rigor mortis leadership process. All of us can damn and condemn the nature of term limits and the nature of how legislators are plotting their leadership posts by the time they're, well, even before they're elected. But I would offer you to consider that that does net some favorable results. Both of our chamber leaders have by fortune of, well, at least in one I can think, he had to lose a seat and then come back. Richard Corcoran's lost a race as well. These are well-tenured Florida leaders in both instances with Joe Negron and Richard Corcoran. Richard Corcoran's career with the state goes back at least 25 years. So the first thing I'd ask you to consider is this is not the freshman that suddenly clawed his way to the top and in 6 years finds himself leading one of the largest states in the nation. Both Joe Negron and Richard Corcoran have a long tenure, and they'll apply that. I don't know that I can comment deeply about the nature of their policy. Obviously, Richard Corcoran is angling to, you know, find to open up some room on the right end of the Republican Party, and Joe Negron is seeking a more moderate path. He has some libertarian thinkings in his past that serves him very well. So, you know, the Senate is probably going to fall into its more typical position of where the House proposes and the Senate disposes, and will probably be a little more recalcitrant. I would offer you this one observation that would might confound that, though, in that to our notion of history around in this town, this is probably the youngest Senate we have seen in easily 30 or 40 years, and it is also the Senate that contains the largest class of House members entering the Senate than we've seen in probably about 20 years. So if that changes the nature of the Senate, which has always been senatorial, then we might have a more vigorous policy production from the Senate. You also might see that change a little bit out of the nature of Speaker Corcoran, in that this is a gentleman who has made his strongest statements in his developing political career, not by passing legislation, but by stopping legislation. He was the symphony director behind the state's opposition to Medicaid expansion, which you'll recall about 3 years ago got very controversial in this state. And then, of course, last year, he fairly well orchestrated the disposal of the governor's economic development funds. So here's a guy who has built his career on not passing big pieces of legislation, but stopping it. And so if that might change the nature of the House from where the House proposes and the Senate disposes and puts a little more creative pressure on the Senate to come up with policy, we might see that shift a little bit this year as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. And Barney, thank you. And thank you all very, very much. We at Florida Tax Watch are honored. Is it on?
It's not on.
Thank you very much, Nancy. Thank you, Barney. And thank you all for coming. Many of you longstanding friends. I've been have the honor to serve you and the people of Florida for a good 37 years now. And I hope you don't say, that's long enough, Dominic, get the hell out of here. So at Florida Texas, we really do try to be your eyes and ears. We've been working with our good friends at NFIB, at Assisted Industries of Florida, both with Barney previously and now with Tom, who's and Bruce, who's been great partners of ours, as the eyes and ears looking out for how the policies and practices of Florida, which really our great constitution does a lot of wonderful things for us, if only our nation had some of the checks and balances that our state constitution has, we would not be in the deficit situation. And I look briefly to the founders, this is something we probably wouldn't talk about, but it's very important. It's going to affect your pocketbook and ultimately the economy of the world. And that is the fact that we continue to print money like it's literally going out of style. And the founders of our nation never, ever anticipated that. They didn't even have that as a proposed amendment to the Constitution, okay? Because they thought it was just immoral. They would never pass on that kind of debt to their kids or grandkids. And yet that's some of the intractable things that we're dealing with. Part of the $20 trillion active federal debt, about $7 to $8 trillion of that is just federal unfunded pensions. So that's a big issue. In Florida, though, we have that still a challenge our government pensions, but the big issues I think are going to be the following. Business rent tax, in addition to workers' comp, I think the legislature is going to pass hopefully something that's favorable to businesses. If it's good for business, I think generally it's going to be good for the employees. I mean, it's got to be. It doesn't help a business if you shortchange and screw the employees. It's not a workable long-term solution. You only make money, and Bill knows this, and you all know this, all of you. Peggy, all of you. Bill, everyone here knows that you only make money when your employees are working for you very proactively and very actively. So I think that's going to be important. The other one is business rent tax. We're the only state in the nation that has a sales and use tax on commercial rents. And it's really become an increasingly serious problem. It's one that creates a lot of economic distortions. Last year, Tax Watch recommended, we met with the governor, included it based on that recommendation in his budget changes, and so we think that's going to be very, very important. The real challenge, though, ultimately is, what we're trying to fix long-term is, you got a collision course of sorts of policy, and it doesn't have to get nasty. It just can be an opportunity to really change the budget process. We had only about $70 million new general revenue available to fund the state. And you got the Senate president who wants to spend $1 to $2 billion on water quality and some things that really do need to be done in Southeast Florida. We cannot have a healthy economy, let alone a safe one, if you can't have safe drinking water. I mean, it's just, this is bad for safety and everything else, especially bad for business. And also,
we only have 2 minutes, you have to close it up.
Okay. And also in education, the other area though is really going to be pretty important. So we've got to change the whole budget process. What we have now is outdated, anachronistic, and harmful to the people of Florida. And we have solutions to solve that.
Okay. Remember that we have 2 minutes, and I am sorry that you have to meld your opening remarks into the first question, but carry on.
You know, I think from what I've been watching, you know, as the presiding officers move forward and start talking about their policies, what we've seen from Speaker Corcoran is right out of the gate, these House policy and rule changes that I think are going to be very impactful to how the Senate moves forward on their appropriations process. What Speaker Corcoran has said is any appropriation request, any member project, any appropriation request has to have a standalone House bill. The bill does not need to be heard, but they need to have a bill filed from a member of the House. Well, that is an absolute about face and change from the way it's been done in the past, where things can be slid in the dead of night and in conference reports. So what you're going to have is all of these senators coming out who have been doing this for a long time and having these member projects that they need and want funding for, where they're going to have to go to the House and find an elected official, a House member, to go out and sponsor that bill. It's going to be very interesting to watch how the Senate goes about doing that. Because that is an absolute sea change in the way things have been done for really forever here in the Florida legislature. So that's going to be very interesting to watch, talking about the two presiding officers. And I think, you know, when you had mentioned how Florida can be more competitive, we've got several things out there now that Florida can go out and do in the legislature to make Florida a little bit more competitive, especially with our surrounding states. One of them is workers' compensation reform. What we've seen from these Supreme Court cases is an increase in workers' compensation rates for 14.5%. Florida jumped six spots, jumped six states, being more costly to do business or workers' compensation rates. Interestingly enough, three of those states were Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, states we compete with. Another one is the business rent tax, like Dominic said, which we're the only state in the nation that charges a business rent tax. In addition, a DEP rule that has come out, that AIF and NFIB and several others have challenged, that requires businesses to go report to DEP and the media, most importantly the media and local elected officials, of any spill they might have on their site. And I can get into that a little bit later, because it's a very detrimental rule that's come out.
Thank you very much. Okay, this is a two-part question. Governor Scott is asking for $85 million for economic incentives. Speaker Corcoran has categorically stated there will be no corporate welfare in the House budget. So I'm asking this. Do you support tax-funded economic development incentives to recruit business to Florida? Second part, if economic incentives fail in the 2017 legislature, what can we do to continue economic development and job growth without them? Your ideas, please. Bill?
Well, historically, my organization has not been a great fan of economic development. Small business owners tend to want to stick to Main Street. However, I will tell you that I've been with this organization for a long time, and we started to see changes in that through the last recession in 08 and 09, when business owners realized that the biggest problem with their business was a lack of customers, and economic development does bring customers. So we are seeing the small business community change on that issue. As for my organization, we don't plan on beating the marble over in the Capitol a whole lot. To advance economic development, we see the best opportunities to grow jobs in this state over the next year is to remedy the workers' compensation crisis. And there is some information that just needs to be imparted with audiences on that. First of all, I'd ask you to consider it from a slightly larger perspective. Workers' compensation is always seen as business versus the trial lawyers beating heads in the Capitol. But what I'd ask you to consider is that every salary and wage earner in this state has a workers' compensation cost attached to them. If we can't keep those costs down, it affects not just Main Street, not just corporate Florida, but all of our municipal employees, all of our school teachers, all of our police, firefighters are all protected by workers' compensation.
That's coming.
And when we
that's
see those costs
coming.
Go up, then we're paying for that as taxpayers as well. Now, leave it at that.
Thank you, Nancy. I think the first question is that I don't think you'll see many economic development incentives because the House just won't let it happen. There's not a lot of money there to start with. The big one now is to make sure we don't lose a lot of the tourist development that we've had. When Governor Scott took over, we had about 87 million tourists. We now have about 109 million tourists a year. TaxWatch has played an important role in researching that and helping look at the ROI, return on investment, to get to the 100 million tourists. We've got to maintain and sustain that. It does take, first, improving the quality of Florida, the product that you have to offer, but you have to sell it. It does not sell itself. There's a lot of other communities that are doing it, so let's not be penny wise and pound foolish. The tourists had tremendous impact to our economy, to our businesses, all across the state. And it's not just seasonal. It's actually not seasonal. It's all different kinds of tourism in so many ways. It adds billions of dollars to our economy, hundreds of billions of dollars to our economy, and between 3 to 4, maybe as much as $7, $8, $9 billion to the state budget.
To answer your question, AIF has been very supportive of the governor's proposal on business incentives to bring new businesses here to Florida and also to increase growth of current businesses here in the state. I don't believe that money is going to materialize. Speaker Corcoran has already said this is a no-go. And it's unfortunate because, you know, companies, when they sit around a boardroom and look at potentially moving their headquarters to a state, they look at what states are going to give them. You know, there's probably a reason we don't have an auto manufacturer here in the state, and our surrounding sister states do. Texas is essentially almost giving away land to bring companies in. Toyota is moving from California and up in the New York area to Plano. In addition to that, I mean, look at the film industry here in Florida. I recently read an article that they are building Ybor City lookalike up in Georgia because they got better incentives to do that. I mean, that's absurd that it is cheaper to go out and build an entire city to film in than it is to film in that city. So AIF has been a longtime supporter of incentives, and you know, we wish the money would materialize, but I think Speaker Corcoran has essentially said, you know, I'm not for that, so good luck.
Okay, the next question I'd like to ask is about the Trump administration. What should we expect the impacts to be in Florida if the Trump administration is successful in repealing Obamacare?
Again, did anyone see this coming? But a few prudent people have begun plans in this regard. Florida is unique in that politically we were one of the most resistant states to the implementation of Obamacare. Translate that into public policy, the Medicaid debate, which I referred to, we declined on that, we eschewed that. On the other hand, Florida has some of the highest enrollment in the Obamacare exchanges than any other state, so that's going to be the balancing act that the legislature is going to have to pursue. We are recommending to the legislature that it is prudent to begin assembling that list. I serve on a health insurance advisory board to the insurance commissioner, sort of a nuts and bolts group that is meeting in December, and I know that we will begin assembling lists of that which needs done and undone in light of perhaps the ACA being repealed in DC. So thus far it looks like it will be a lot of housekeeping. Much will depend on how much of it they repeal. And of course, the ultimate disposition of those that are currently covered under ACA exchange policies will dictate to us what the fallout will be. But thus far, it looks like it's simply a housekeeping list that will have to be dealt with.
Nancy, I think mainly what we're going to see is, it's already been expressed that it won't be an outright total repeal. I mean, they may have to repeal it and replace it, but I think you can see a lot of components of existing pre-existing conditions and things of that nature, which are probably beneficial. There are other components of the Obamacare that are actually harmful to the economy. Generally, if it's harmful to the economy, it's not going to be good for any particular community, where it rewarded people to not be healthy, where it rewards people to not take care of themselves and price accordingly. So I think as we can build some of those good safeguards in place, there'll be a lot of good proposals that'll be probably a little bit more market-driven and hopefully turn a system which has been growing, once was 15% of the economy, 12, you know, now it's like one fifth of the economy, moving up to be one quarter of the economy. So it's costing us more and more money because it's so unresponsive to the marketplace. The customer does not decide what he or she wants or needs, decide who can provide it, and then actually have a real skin in the game to pay for it. So we have third parties paying it. We've got to change that, make it more market driven, and yet still compassionate and responsive and innovative.
Yeah, I think like both of these gentlemen said, a lot of it is going to be, you know, in this post-Obamacare world, what is going to be repealed and replaced? What is going to be repealed in Obamacare? You know, what you see now is, you know, almost every single Republican governor out there talking about Medicaid, and Medicaid being such a large part of our state budget and probably most other state budgets. Most of them are starting to talk about Medicaid block grants now, something that, you know, the Obama administration has been adamantly opposed to, but I think Trump would be much more willing to discuss and implement. And what, you know, look here in Florida, I mean, Governor Scott, one of the first people out of the gate supporting President-elect Trump, knows healthcare inside and out, has been a proponent of the Medicaid block grants as well. So I think, you know, looking at that and looking at some of these big dollar issues that can change under President Trump and maybe potentially repealing some of those Obamacare initiatives, it's going to be very important to watch. You know, we also have some LIP funding, the low income pool funding, which dried up, slowly started to dry up under Obama. You know, it replacing that with a Medicaid drop block grant and those types of things.
Okay. The cornerstone of Donald Trump's environmental policy is to remove as many regulations as possible in order to allow American businesses more operational freedom and greater room to grow. He has targeted the Environmental Protection Agency. Certainly the oil and gas industries are watching closely. So my question to you is, what do you think a looser Trump EPA is likely to mean, both good and bad, to Florida?
Well, this one, I think we have even less of a crystal ball available to us than we do on the president-elect's view towards the ACA. You know, regulation is a funny thing. Very few people are wanting to regulate Peggy Monroe, but everyone wants to regulate the big corporations and how we write those so that they don't affect Tallahassee Main Street as much is the trick. There is also that paradox of, you know, one business's regulation is another business's competitive advantage of over one of their competitors. So deregulation is always been a paradox for the business community, and we're always, well, we shouldn't be surprised that when we go down that road, often some of the fiercest opponents or obstacles to it are other people who are regulated themselves. That being said, though, we have a great opportunity in Florida to create a new kind of dialogue in the Department of Environmental Protection issue that Brewster alluded to earlier, attended to a unreported spill. The governor put out a very, very strong public notice rule on environmental spillages into land, water, or air that aren't quite crystallized yet, and we continue to work with the governor to come up with something that's a little more workable. But I will tell you, out of the gate, you know, somewhat out of character for what how some people may perceive this governor, he's taken a very, very strong pro-notification, pro-consumerist viewpoint on this important regulation. So there'll be a different kind of dialogue in Florida.
All right.
Nancy, I think there's going to be two kind of components. One is the pendulum of regulation has swung very much towards, in some cases, over-regulation in matters that don't necessarily improve the quality or the safety of that which is regulating. Okay, it's actually stifling economic commerce and growth. So one, moderating that without sacrificing quality, safety of the environment, and the well-being of the people it's designed to serve is really critically important. But on the other hand, the other thing that's got to be done is to make sure that other countries that we do trade with, that they have meaningful regulation, similar quality products and services, so that when we buy them, we know what we're getting, and that they have similar kind of safeguards, so we're trading more fairly and evenly. And secondly, that they're, we can see and sporadically check and verify that they are, in fact, honoring those regulatory standards as well. So that whether it's food, whether it's housing products or paint or whatever, we know that what we're buying is similar to the quality of what we're enjoying in our country, so that trade is actually more fair. So I think President-elect can really hit the chord, and that is to make sure that our trade practices are fair and more reasonable, so that we are really trading in an honest basis and having real, true, genuine competition.
Okay, thank you, Debbie.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what President-elect Trump has said about EPA and also our oil and gas industries here in the United States is something that, you know, I hope he can make true on his promises. You know, I think I would hope one of the first things he would do away with is the Waters of the United States rule. You know, currently, well, in the past, federal jurisdiction fell over only over navigable pieces of water that you could take a boat up and down. What Waters of the U.S., WOTUS did, anything flowing into a navigable piece of water. So any stream in a heavy downpour that could flow into a body of water is under, could be under federal jurisdiction. Some people went as far as to say is you know, holding ponds in construction zones, truck ruts in construction sites that hold water for a certain amount of time could be under federal jurisdiction. And you can imagine you know, the EPA's how they would love to just come down and shut down certain projects, as they could say this is now under federal jurisdiction. And also, I think, you know, increasing America's accessing their own natural resources, that being oil and gas, we could see a potential easing of restrictions on outer continental shelf oil exploration and drilling under a Trump administration. But I think that's something he did come out early saying, and I think he's probably going to come, you know, follow through with his promises.
Okay, thank you. The next three questions I'm going to ask should only take you about 30 seconds to answer. They're very, very simple questions. The first is, did your organization support or oppose Amendment 2, the medical marijuana amendment, and why?
No, we did not take a position on that.
Why?
We didn't find an intensity from a small business owner's opinion on that.
We did feel very strongly recommended against it, only because we thought it was not necessary. And also, we don't want to promote laws that are contrary to the federal government's laws. It's not a good idea for states to directly violate federal law. It's not a good idea, not a good public policy.
AIF did not weigh in on Amendment 2. It's just not something that our members brought to our attention.
Okay, the next question is, do you favor minimum wage increase? And if so, how much? How do you determine that?
No, obviously, being an advocate for independent business owners, we don't support artificial wage determinations, and that's basically their principle. They want to be able to, and they firmly believe that it results in a diminution of our job capacity in this state. So we oppose them. It's irrelevant for us to start stating on what an appropriate minimum wage would be in that regard.
Texas would like to have the conversation change to set a minimum wage. This whole idea of minimum standards to a starting wage. It's a real concept there. It's not really a minimum, it's a starting wage. But the bottom line is I think it should be nationwide because it has unintended consequences. And secondly, it should be adjusted from time to time. So it's not a big leap from, you know, over once every 10 years. So it should be moderate and minimal, anticipated. But the bottom line is the more we make people valuable, that they have the skills, the talent, the knowledge, to deploy, we have so many jobs that just go unfilled in the United States. So all these artificial minimum wage demands never address them. They actually make them worse, particularly for young people that want jobs, can't get them because the cost is too high. So what do businesses do? They go out of their way to have artificial ways of having contract employees and the like, because the intent is well intended, but it actually hurts the very people it's designed to help. So historically, even Bill Clinton and his administration as president discovered that minimum wage hikes generally do not really help the very people that are designed to serve.
AIF has been adamantly opposed to any minimum wage increase for the same reasons that are stated here. We just don't believe it creates jobs. We believe it actually destroys jobs and doesn't end up having any sort of business growth that goes along with an artificial minimum wage increase.
Thank you. Senator Negron has been emphatic that all state employees receive wage increases this year. Do you have an idea of how much that should be, and would you oppose it altogether?
For my organization's sake, we certainly wouldn't oppose it. We think our perspective on the revenue flow this year is that it is going to be extremely tight. I think that if there's anything that will float up to the out to the business community, it could be the rent tax that Dominic talked about, although in a very much diminished manner than it was proposed over the last couple years. Historically, we have not opposed any adjustments to state workers, and I would trust Dominic's counsel on that.
You know, I say as a matter of priorities, it doesn't rise to the top 10 for the statewide leadership in Florida. Frankly, there are a lot of increases in state employment salaries. They just move around jobs. They don't keep the same job. You don't say as accountant two, you go to accountant three or four, and you get a pay raise. That's how it's been increasing over time. And people are moving in and out of the system. The real thing is we're choking on a pension system that is very hard, very difficult. We have about a $24 billion deficit each year because we're only funding about 85% of the Florida retirement system, which is one of the better funded in the country. And that is assuming a 7.75% annual rate of return. Repeat, 7.75%. How many of you are getting an annual 7.75% return long term? No. When you reduce it from 7.75 to 7.70, you reduce the assets and the liability an extra $2 or $3 billion. Imagine if you bring it down to 6.0. You're going to bring a $24 billion deficit to probably nearly $40 billion. My point is, it's very fragile, and it's far more fragile than we realize. So we're going to be unable to meet the demands of public safety, education, and critical infrastructure investments until we address this, hopefully by the Constitution there is your commission because the legislature doesn't have the chutzpah to do what needs to be done.
AIF, we don't take any position on increasing wages for state workers. It's not something our corporate members have ever come to us and said we need to engage in this. I leave that up to the men and women of the Florida legislature to go out and fight that fight, because it's probably going to be a fight. But we have no position on increasing state worker pay rate or pay scales.
Okay, the next question is very near and dear to my heart. I know that. Do you favor Joe Negron's proposal for water storage south of Lake Okeechobee, which would use an annual $100 million of documentary stamp tax revenue set aside by Amendment 1 over the next 20 years? Whether yes or no, please explain why.
Yeah, again, you know, I suppose organizations like ourselves have our priorities, and this is not one of them. We are not going to take a position in opposition, and I guess it's the nature of the strong leader format we have in the Florida legislature that it, you know, things like this will wait for someone that has really got, you know, the desire to charge up that hill, and then public policy is achieved in one ginormous gulp. Which will then tend to, you know, clear a lot of the rest of the issues and a lot of the rest of the legislative spending opportunities for that two-year period off the table. If that's the nature of what we're achieving in these 2 years, then so be it. That's the creature, the leadership style we have in Florida. But the consequence of it is that it will pretty well evaporate some of the opportunities for some of the other more direct business-oriented tax reductions, or for that matter, some of the other spending issues that you've identified will be evacuated off the table.
Nancy, this gives the legislature and the people of Florida a great opportunity to really begin to change a very outdated budgeting system and spending system. We have this incremental system that just takes last year's budget. We don't have 100% budgeting. We have about 405% budgeting. Take last year's budget and add a little inflation, cost of living, workload increases. So we've been kicking the can down the road. So if we have $1 or $2 billion more, they can get by. But since they don't, they're gonna actually have to, if they wanna spend money on new things like this water restoration area, which I think is a really sound idea, and something Test, which is actually studying, and secondly, even higher education, we're gonna have to find the money elsewhere. Part of it will be taken from groups that think it's their money, they're entitled to, which they're not. But secondly, it's a long time that we need to look at maybe having an annual productivity legislation. Each year have government cost savings. Now the only system is how can the budget get bigger, not necessarily better, more effective, more efficient. There's no systemic effort by the agencies of the governor or the legislature each year to say, how can we do that more efficiently? How can we do that more effectively? And if we have a law that required every year, that maybe we find $1 billion to $2 billion each year of efficiencies, as well as growth in the budget, and then we start to have some real innovations. I think this is an opportunity to change it, because a crisis creates a great opportunity.
AIF is supportive of cleaning up Lake Okeechobee, but we do not believe that storage south of the lake is the way to do it. You know, you currently have yearly, I mean, it averages per rainfall, but about 1.8 million acre foot of water pouring in from the lake from the north end. What Senator Negron is proposing to do, President Negron, would only potentially maybe deal with 30% of that. What we believe is, let's store it north of the lake. Why are we writing off Lake Okeechobee as a holding pond for water before we send it off south of the lake? Lake Okeechobee for decades has been a great economic engine for that surrounding area. Let's store this water north of the lake. Let's clean up the lake before it gets in there. And that can be done in a number of ways, reservoirs north of the lake, but most importantly, deep water storage, deep well storage. There's currently 240 deep well storage wells operating here in the state. If we put 80 north of the lake, that would potentially take, that would take about 88% of the water coming south off the table. It would take it away from going into the lake. You wouldn't have it going out of the sides of the Caloosahatchee and out of the Indian River Lagoon. And then we wouldn't have to send anything south of the lake, and we would have a clean lake. So AIS position is, yes, let's clean this lake up, or let's clean it up before it gets in the lake.
Thank you. Although a Leon County judge blocked the December 1st start of the 14.5% workers' compensation rate hike, attorneys can still go back into cases and claim fees retroactively. This is very costly. I'm not quite sure how costly, but I bet you Bill Hurley knows. What are you doing, in fact, what are you able to do to fight it?
Well, we do have some breaking news, and please check this out if I do get this incorrect, because it was only texted to me, but as of just before lunch, that order was stayed, so the vacating the 14.5% rate increase that happened just Wednesday afternoon before Thanksgiving is now put on hold. Those rate increases will go out on Thursday, December 1, to business owners and school districts and county commissioners across the state. There's a little bit of some confusing choreography that's going on in this, and obviously it's not good for the business community to have, you know, 14% on, 14% off, and we might even ping pong this thing a few more times before the bills get actually paid. It all arrives as a lot of disruption to the business community. But this is what I would like you to understand about this issue. This is about additional attorney's fees in what is supposed to be a self-executing system. The Rating Bureau and the Office of Insurance has calculated that lifting the restriction on attorney's fees in the workers' compensation is going to cost the system at least another $523 million in attorney's fees next year alone. That will go up every year. And call me a cynic, but I am suggesting to you that, you know, this case on remanding the rate increase, although it comes as good news to the business owners that have to pay it, be careful of those you invite into your city gates proclaiming themselves as liberators, because I don't think that is their goal. Ultimately, these attorney's fees are being paid. The insurance industry will find a way through the Office of Insurance Regulation to catch up on these rates, and then it's going to hit the business community with even a very much a harder thump. The workers' compensation system is supposed to be self-executing. They are trying to conceal just how much attorney's fees they are extracting from the system through all this litigation.
Thanks. I'll try to keep it short. I think basically you want to make sure you have a workers' comp system that puts injured workers back to the job as quickly as possible. They rehabilitate to the maximum extent situation circumstances permit, and that to keep third parties out of this as much as possible is not only functional, it's beyond desirable. It's exactly what has to occur, and there's got to be a new method or mechanism statutorily that allows that to happen. Because as Bill says, it's not just a camouflaging, it's basically changing the basic structure so that we put injured workers back at jobs as quickly as possible and as seamlessly as possible. That's the goal of everybody. Unfortunately, a third party here is going to get rich if they intervene under the guise of helping those that they're really not helping.
Yeah, Nancy, I believe, you know, the unfunded liability on that is about, there's an article that said it was about $1 billion right now that insurance companies are carrying because of all of these attorneys now coming out and saying, well, you know, we have cases in the pipeline, I can go back and look at my cases. I mean, you know, this case was essentially an $800 workers' compensation payment to a worker, and the attorney got $35,000 out of it. So this, you know, this is not to get workers healthy. This makes attorneys wealthy, and that is the bottom line. They are not going to go try to settle cases. They're going to drag them out as long as they can. I've talked to several workers' compensation defense attorneys who said they've talked to retired workers' comp plaintiffs attorneys who are coming back out of retirement because they know how much money they can make off of this. And it's off the backs of the men and women in this room. And it's absolutely absurd that you know, that these people go out there and simply want to just get rich off of injured workers. Our goal is to get that worker healthy and get them back into the workforce, not dragging it out so they can go buy a new yacht.
Okay, we only have time for one more question before your closing statements. But is it time to repeal PIP, the state's no-fault insurance requirement? Let's hear your fault.
No. I'll try that one.
I'd stick with Bill on that. I'd say no.
Yeah, I mean, I would tend to agree with the gentleman up here. I mean, it is something, you know, Florida being one of the few states that has a no-fault insurance policy right now. But there are several legislators out there who want to revisit that. AIF was very instrumental in working with Governor Scott and his last PIP reform. But there are several legislators who have gone out there and kind of indicated that they would like to look at that issue to potentially get Florida back or get Florida to where I think the majority of states are you know, at fault states. So I don't believe we would be supportive of that at this juncture.
Okay, now we're going to just have a two-minute closing statement from each of you. Bill?
Well, I want to thank this wonderful group and what a great attendance, and I hope to become a regular participating member in NEBA. I would say, you know, listen, we've all been through one heck of a political season. We're all Tallahasseans here, and we're all Floridians here. And for me, it's a source of pride that for all the problems that myself and Dominic and Brewster can describe, we kind of are one of the more effective levels of government serving ourselves and our fellow citizens. And so while people have a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen in Washington, we've all known that for some time that Washington has been fairly broken. So it is somewhat reassuring to know that other levels of government are, while you have harsh critics among all of us of it, is a little more effective than others. And we can take some solace in that, but it only works through participation. And I would, you know, invite all of you to roll from this hill down across the valley and up the other hill and visit and participate in state government this year. It absolutely makes a difference. We have traditionally a very strong delegation in North Florida. I think that hasn't changed at all. In fact, I think it's probably been greatly enhanced with the elections, and they're a pretty responsive bunch. So I know all of you engage politically, but I would just encourage you, it's a little bit more important these days than it has in recent past.
Thank you, Nancy. I want to say, I think mainly, I'm very thankful. This is Thanksgiving season, but it's also Advent, Christmas season, and New Year's coming upon us. I want to thank each of you that are members of Florida Tax Office supporters. You help us do good fight with Bill and fight with Brewster and others to help make Florida a great state. We have the best state in the nation, and our best days are ahead of us. So I want to say thank you all for that. But secondly, I think there's something that's going on in this country is something that happened with Brexit, and that is the sense that we've got to become and remember that the world is a dangerous place with America in it, okay? And it's really critically important to make sure that America is absolutely economically, militarily, and morally the strongest nation in the world. And if it isn't, it's a much uglier and unsafe place. And so I hope this election, in part, is more about e pluribus unum. We don't forget that. Yes, we respect and appreciate diversity, but we're Americans first and foremost, okay? And I think a sense of national pride is good, as long as I'm xenophobic. We accept other people and their differences and all that. But remember, from many, we are one, and we're Americans first. We're not Tallahasseans first, we're not Floridians first, we're Americans first. And maybe that's the lesson that we begin to remember and learn. And let's make sure our heroes are, most importantly, the founders. Not sports heroes, not these entertainment heroes, but our founders that have really enabled the blood, sweat, and tears to make the freezer we enjoy today. Thank you all very much.
You mean not the media?
No. Straighten them out too, man. Yeah. Let's go.
I would just like to thank all of you all for allowing me the opportunity to come and talk with you all. I mean, obviously, you know, from what you've heard, and we just scratched the surface on legislative issues that we could be hearing this year that are going to impact you guys on a daily basis. Like Bill said, make sure you go out and talk to your elected officials about it. That's why they're there. Talk to them about the workers' compensation rate increase. Talk to them about the business rent tax, because that is money out of y'all's pocket. That is money that y'all could put back into your businesses on infrastructure, hiring new people, giving people increased wages. And so you going out and advocating for those issues is very important. You know, we do it every day. They see us coming in their offices probably more than they want to see us coming in their offices. But when you guys come in there and you tell the story of how it impacts you on the ground and how it impacts their constituents, they really do listen. So make sure you go do that. You know, thanks to Barney for having me. Barney also hired me at AIF, so I greatly appreciate that. And thanks to my mom and dad for not telling any embarrassing stories about me.
Yeah, we're still
yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much, all of you.
You've been listening to a delayed broadcast of the NEBA, Network of Entrepreneurs and Business Advocates, luncheon meeting of November 29th, 2016. This program was recorded at the Capital City Country Club in Tallahassee. Join us again next time for another NEBA luncheon meeting on WFSU-FM.